الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise." Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Zionist war machine has once again breached the sovereignty of a West Asian state, hitting HTS-led regime positions in Syria. Over the last few days, HTS forces are engaged in clashes with the Druze community in Soweto province, a purely Syrian problem. Yet Israeli occupation forces interject first in Soweto and then target Syrian capital Damascus with missiles against state and military institutions. So why has Israel, as serial violator of regional state sovereignty, carried out such an escalated form of aggression against Syria? And what's the pretext being used here? And how valid is that pretext? So what other machinations and thoughts may be at play here? It is what we'll be discussing in our Spotlight program. But first, here's a report to shed more light on the story ahead.
Days of brutal fighting gripped Sweida, a city long dominated by Syria's Druze minority. Clashes began on Sunday, sparking an intervention by HGS forces who joined with the Bedouin in attacking Druze fighters. The Israeli regime took advantage of the chaos and attacked several parts of the Arab country, including Defense Ministry headquarters and the presidential palace in Damascus. Tel Aviv claims it's acted to protect the Druze minority. The clashes left more than 350 people dead and hundreds more injured. Just hours after the Israeli strikes on Wednesday, a ceasefire brokered by international mediators took effect. HTS troops pulled back from Sweida, signaling at least a temporary pause to the bloodshed. The agreement includes a complete halt to HTS military operations in the city and the full integration of the Sweida province into the Syrian state. Israel's wave of airstrikes on Syria has sparked strong condemnations from global and regional leaders, as well as international organizations. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has described Israel as a rabid regime that knows no bounds and understands only the language of force. He reaffirmed Iran's support for Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, calling on the international community to unite and stop Israel's crimes. The UN chief spokesman, slamming the strikes, called for the immediate cessation of all violations of Syrian sovereignty and territorial integrity.
The Secretary General further condemns Israel's escalatory airstrikes on Sweida, Dara, and in the center of the Syrian capital, Damascus, as well as reports of Israeli Defense Forces' redeployment of forces in the Golan.
The European Union urged Tel Aviv to immediately halt its strikes. Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, China, and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council have also condemned the Israeli aggression. The Arab League called out Tel Aviv for seeking to sow chaos in Syria by exploiting the events in Sweida. Resistance groups like Hamas, Ansarallah, and Hezbollah have also denounced the attacks. Experts argue Israel wants to divide and fragment Syria by supporting separatists.
The Israelis met with the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, predominantly Kurdish, to empower them against the HDS-led government in Syria. So it's about supporting the separatists trying to support a project that would divide and fragment Syria.
Peace in Syria remains precarious despite a ceasefire. Recent Israeli airstrikes have sent alarms ringing that Tel Aviv aims to keep Syria fractured and weak as part of a broader strategy to reshape the region's power dynamics in its own favor.
And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Nick Napier, activist and commentator out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. And Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst, joining us out of Johannesburg. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I guess, Mick, we'll start with you out there in the United Kingdom. Your initial take on what Israel is doing in Syria. It's already violated the country with a gross expansion, you very well know, of its occupation. So why this escalated level of aggression and interference where it's pitting state buildings inside the heart of the capital?
One can't accuse the Israelis of being inconsistent. They have sought to weaken and destroy Syrian society and state over a very long period. When the Assad regime fell, Israel took the opportunity to try to destroy as much of the military infrastructure that they could reach. Because their goal is to make sure that they are surrounded by very weak or even devastated Arab countries or clients of the US who are paralyzed by that client relationship. So it's been very consistent. And I think one explains the Israeli attitude towards the new regime in Damascus by saying that they might both like to do a deal to normalize their relations, but it comes up against the problem that Israel wants to hold to hold on to the land that it seized with the fall of the Assad government, and the land that it seized in 67 and held back and held on to in 73. So the appetite of the Israelis is to seize as much as a large chunk of Syrian territory and hold on to it. After all, they got away with it with the Golan. America recently even recognized Israel's occupation and incorporation of the Golan into so-called Israeli territory. So they have an appetite, perhaps, to continue that and do even more. But it fits also into a bigger picture that a pretty small state of 7 million or even just 6 million Zionist Jews, surrounded by a variety of Arab states, has to strive to either destroy and devastate or weaken to such a degree, or dominate like Jordan and other states, that they don't pose a threat. So the price of the continued existence of the Israeli state is destruction and devastation and domination of the wider area. And that's what the history shows.
Thank you there, Mick. And Zach here from Johannesburg, thank you for your patience. Welcome to our conversation here, Bud. And your opening take on why Israel is getting involved in Syria's internal affairs when many feel it was part, along with the U.S., part and parcel of the HTS takeover back in early December?
I think that we must look at the Druze community within both Syria and Israel as an extension of Israel. And this is not my opinion. This is in the academic literature. There's a very interesting paper that was authored from Georgetown University's Journal of International Affairs by Dr. Eve Kerr. And she speaks about the importance of the Druze community towards Israel's military aspirations. In fact, the Druze have the highest enrollment rates in the IDF. 80% of Druze males in Israel are enlisted with the IDF. And they use them for sensitive areas such as Haram al-Sharif, the compound, and areas on the border. These are key individuals within the structures of Israel. And this is also something that predates the current developments within Syria. If we look at the times of Israel, around June of 2015, Moshe Bogi Yalon, the former defense minister, gave an interesting briefing to foreign journalists and foreign advisors, where he said that, yes, they had certain conditions for supplying armaments to groups like Jaishat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, the other al-Qaeda movements that were found within Syria. It's that don't come too close to our borders and do not touch the Druze. So in that sense, they are completely aligned. Where we see Israel intervening now is two things. Yes, there's an understanding between Turkey, and we have to look at Shahra as part of Turkey's larger ambitions within the region, and Israel, that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which was the resistance axis. They wanted to remove the resistance axis from Syria. However, Israel, through the Druze now, are trying to project power, are trying to create the strategic depth, and Mr. Napier correctly states, it's a small state. So when you keep this area of Soweda, if you look at the areas of Golan, this creates strategic depth for Israel, which is tactically beneficial for them. And therefore, this is just about military expansionism, and this is in line with what was said by Hezbollah, that this is about dominating the region. It's all part of Israel's larger plan.
And Mick, I'd like you to actually elaborate exactly on what Zakir said, because here's a peculiar thing here. Israel is using the Druze as pretext, we all understand. But here's the Druze, an openly separatist entity and movement there in Syria, but it's been Israel's game plan in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Iraq. It's tried it in Iran. It's trying it now in Syria to try to divide and conquer and keep a nation from being unified, especially Syria now with all the challenges it has.
Well, certainly. I mean, if you put pins in the map, Israel sought and for a while found clients in Lebanon among a certain section, but not the whole. A certain section of the Christian community. That community had been cultivated by the imperial power France as a loyalist group with varied success, and Israel continued that. So that's Lebanon. But, you know, you look the same thing. If in Iraq, Israel's meddling in the Kurdish areas in the north, trying to, with some degree of success, finding clients there that it can use against the central government. Israel's attacked Tunisia. In Sudan, Israel certainly influenced building in South Sudan and has done so for a very long time. So it's a very clear pattern of trying to find minority allies to use against central governments. And it fits into the picture I mentioned before of the absolute necessity for such a tiny country to not allow the rise of a strong state with a strong military, because such a strong state with a strong military will inevitably come into collision with Israel at a certain point. And so I think it's been remarkably consistent since 1948 and the founding of the Zionist state that it has sought to weaken, attack, divide and find clients in as many neighbouring countries as it possibly can. And it does this with the agreement. It did this with the agreement of the previous dominant imperial powers, France and Britain, and then when America replaced them with the support of America as well. Yes, the plan is not to build influence that stops at the Jordan River, but to dominate the region and to use Israel as an attack dog against any state that refuses to recognize imperial power. But that's challenged. Israel is reaching the limits of its power. I think it's met its match in Iran, but it's met its match also in the coordination of the axis of resistance. It doesn't seem able to subdue the Yemenis, and it doesn't even seem able to subdue the Palestinian resistance. And you know, 2 years ago, who would have predicted that they could have continued fighting in such a small area with no place to retreat to, as they've done in Gaza? It's a remarkable denial of victory to Israel. And Israel's facing in Yemen, it's facing in Palestine, and it will face more in the future the only situation that America will not tolerate, which is Israel being defeated. Israel can kill, massacre, commit genocide, attack, piracy, whatever, and America will tolerate that, but it will not tolerate Israel being defeated. Like the Shah of Iran, once that client is defeated, America may discard it pretty quickly.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Zakir, yes, there are a lot of people in the region and beyond the region. They're not too happy with Mohammed al-Julani and the HTS taking over Syria. There are also signs of discrimination and rhetoric of ethnic cleansing being perpetrated by the HTS against Syria's minorities in Ceuta, against the Alawites, you remember, between now and December. We also saw that. But guess what everyone's doing? They're not invading Syrian soil. They're letting Syria try to figure it out for itself for the time being. Everyone except for the Israeli entity. What emboldens this regime to easily violate the soil of a nation facing challenges, because almost every country in the region has them?
The position of Israel has been to disregard international law. Concepts of sovereignty of violation of a state, this has been thrown out of the window. And we've seen this with the preemptive strike on the Islamic Republic of Iran, together with the United States in tow. So I don't think that international law is a concern for the Israelis or the USA for that matter. What we are seeing now, yes, even the approach taken by Hezbollah, when you look at the wording of the statement, the references by Sheikh Naim Qasem, that Syria is a sisterly state and they must be given an opportunity to pull itself together. Ahmed al-Sharra al-Jilani is trying very hard to rebrand himself as a statesman. However, when you see these flare-ups of Takfiri ideology, of killing the Alawites, the killing of the Druze, regardless of who started it, but we're seeing the conduct during the particular operations, this is of a great degree of concern. However, this is not to say that the Israelis have a right to intervene on this particular point. The Israelis are doing so because the Druze, as I mentioned in the beginning, is a projection of their power. It's is an extension of their abilities. It is a buffer zone for them. It creates strategic depth for them. And any attack of the Druze, whether they initiated this particular round of conflict or not, is a strategic threat to them. For Israel, the entire region is within their reach, and because of the recent military adventurism, they are fully in the position to use their hubris and to act in the manner that we are seeing now. That is why I believe that we will not see a limitation of Israeli power unless it is by military means. And we see that limitation coming in Gaza, where they have been denied their war goals, that is the complete dismantlement of the resistance there and the return of certain captured individuals.
Thank you, Amik. We have the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemning Israel's escalation in Syria and the redeployment of its forces in occupied Golan Heights. We have the European Union that urged earlier the regime to immediately halt its strikes. Lebanon, Turkey, the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, they all condemned Israel's aggression. Iran, Yemen, Palestine, Oman, the list goes on. Mick, how concerning is it that we lack the proper mechanism to put an end to, what Zakir said, Israel's adventurism in the region? Pardon.
I think the mechanism will be the military pressure exerted from countries like Yemen, which are beyond the ability of Israel to subdue. But to the UN, I mean, this structure was designed after the war to preserve the interests of the victors in World War II. It was very clear. And since that period till today, the record of the UN is not something anyone should be optimistic about. They've launched wars in Korea and elsewhere. They've been unable to prevent America killing 3 million Indochinese or ravaging Central and South America for decades. Why should it be different in the Middle East? It's not. So at the level of the UN intervening, I can't see it, to be honest. I just can't see it. But once again, where do we find hope? I think we find hope in the ability of Israel to be in any power that can defeat Israel and deny it victory. Because I think it's in the nature of a regime like this that it will grow and grow and grow in power until it reaches its maximum and then implodes. It was a much weaker version of a settler colonial state, but the overthrow of apartheid in South Africa was only possible after the devastation of Angola, the devastation of neighbouring countries like Mozambique as well, because that's built into the dynamic of settler colonialism. And I think it's exactly the same with the Jewish supremacist state clamped onto Palestine at the moment, that the price for the people of the region will be very high indeed, because this is a regime which is powerful militarily up to a point, is backed by the most modern weaponry, death ships we could call them, supplied by the USA. It will be defeated, but the cost to the people of the region is going to be high, and it will be higher the longer the state exists, because it can only survive through permanent war and permanent efforts to weaken and deny a good future, a decent future, to all the peoples of the region. And to do that, it seeks minority clients. It fishes in troubled waters everywhere. Anywhere there's a minority community that can be turned against the central government and made into a client of Israel, Israel will be there trying to achieve that. And it does this and builds on the weaknesses of some of the Arab regimes over the last few decades. So it's not a bright future immediately, but the Zionist state, like a balloon, will continue to grow for a while until the resistance overwhelms it.
And Zakir, what we've witnessed as of late is an expansion of the regime's escalation throughout multiple states in the region. You alluded to Iran moments ago, but it's not just Iran, is it? Quite a few states are seeing either some kind of interference or all-out blatant aggression against them by the Zionist entity. It knows it has U.S. military and political cover behind it, along with many European states. So what are the ramifications and impacts of the regime's actions as of late on regional peace moving forward?
The entire region has been destabilized. If we look at the events within Lebanon, the continuous targeting of sites within Lebanon, and particularly sites that have civilians around it, we look at the manner in which they have dealt with Gaza, and they have effectively not just dismantled the entire ability to live in Gaza, but they have dismantled international law along with it. What it has done is that it's exposed international law as an ineffective set of rules that have no bite, that have no enforcement mechanism, unless the global power, that is the United States, is in alignment with such action. So these are the things that Israel has done. It has dismantled any form of accountability. It has exercised the rules of the jungle, where might is right. It has leveraged its technological and AI edge to build up strike packages, to try and leverage the suffering that they will heap upon innocent people, the Dahiya doctrine. And it wasn't just applied in Lebanon. It was applied in Syria. It was applied in Yemen. It was applied in the Islamic Republic of Iran as well, and Iraq. We often forget that the United States has given the cover to Israel to participate in military action within Iraq as well. And these are the hallmarks of a state that is completely gone off the cliff. It's a lunatic state. As my fellow panelist has alluded to, is that the Israeli regime has finite munitions, has finite stamina, and it is indeed correct. It was after the military adventurism of the apartheid government in Africa that brought it to its knees. War costs money, and that is exactly what happened to apartheid South Africa, international pressure. The most recent information that is coming out is that Israel's economy is heavily compromised. The recent engagement, the sparring match with the Islamic Republic of Iran, hits Israel tremendously, and this has caused tremendous difficulty for Israelis themselves. In fact, from South Africa, we are seeing numerous individuals that had relocated to Israel coming back to South Africa. These are indications that people are running away from Israel and that its time is limited, although how difficult it is to see. But if you look at it from a long perspective, yes, it's very clear what the end result is.
And I'm glad, Mick, that Zakir mentioned people running away from Israel, because many people ask me, when do you think Israel will stop its aggressive adventurism in the region? And I tell them I expect the exact opposite to happen. Unless Israel is stopped, this is going to be the new norm for the Zionist entity. And the fact I say that is because liberal Israelis, if there was at one point such a thing, that do not support level of expansionism or aggression by the Zionist entity, or they wanted to see concessions for Palestinians, most of them are either been indoctrinated by the far right or have left or are leaving occupied territories, which means the ones that are going to be left to vote these next generation of politicians into office, the future's not looking bright, is it, Mick?
No, it's extremely frightening, and it should frighten all of us. because not only is Israel genocidal towards the Palestinians, and many people have pointed this out for many decades, but it's also, it's a state which rears its children in the belief, and it's not a negotiable belief, it's core to the Zionist project, that the whole world hates Jews. And that's why they have to go to Palestine and colonize it, because they cannot live among non-Jews. So that dangerous, that is a form of child abuse in a sense, but that rearing of children in that ideology, has already produced open genocide in Palestine, but this is a country with maybe 200 atom bombs and hydrogen bombs. And when the elite that controlling it inculcates this belief into its population, the rest of the world should be worried. But there's another thing, because the previous generation of liberal, atheistic, cultured Zionists were no slouches at ethnic cleansing, but they did it in a particular way. The new element is kind of mad, and I think it's instilling fear even among its allies in Washington, London, and Brussels, because they seem to have an end of days approach. They seem to think that they can slaughter, massacre at will, and maybe even ignore their handler. Zionism was an attack dog in the Middle East, which was protected by the imperial powers, but it may be that now this new generation thinks that with such atom bombs, with such death ships being supplied from Washington, they can escalate to an insane degree.
Thank you, gentlemen.
In terms of their allies.
Thank you, Mick. Time has gotten better. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Mick Napier there joining us from Glasgow, and also Mr. Zakir Ahmed Maya joining us from Johannesburg. This brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Seven damage pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only king.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So one of the important things about the study of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is that it has attracted different people from different backgrounds, different individuals with different ideas and ideologies or opinions, researching and looking at the particular event of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam through a specific lens. And that is not a problem at all, because the event of Karbala, the event of Ashura, the uprising and movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam can be looked through many, many different lenses, and that is not a problem at all. It is such a deep and profound event that it allows for all of these different lenses to actually be focused upon it and find its particular place within it. However, it must also be known that sometimes, even though a particular lens can be used to view the event of Karbala, it must not be mistaken that the primary and the most profound goal of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was that he performed his duty for pleasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that is primary, and that is one of the most important things that is there. However, that does not negate any of the other lenses and opinions that are out there. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners in this episode is titled Imam Hussein's Revolution, Rituals and Inspirations. And inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be exploring this book in a little bit more detail with regards to the author, publisher, and so on and so forth. However, this book must be mentioned, it is a collection of articles that were written regarding Imam Hussein alayhi salam, whether it be for Ashura or an Arba'in, and they were compiled and translated in the book form that we have in front of us and we are introducing to our dear listeners in this episode. So please stay tuned for our next segment when we will be introducing this book or dealing with some of the finer details of this book, inshallah. Mawlana, Mawla Hussein, Mawlana, Mawla Hussein, Mawla Ya Hussein, Mawla Hussein, Mawlana, Mawla Hussein, Mawlana, Mawla Hussein. Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So as we mentioned in our previous segment, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners in this episode is titled Imam Hussein's Revolution, Rituals and Inspiration. This book was authored by Ayatollah Muhammad Jawad Fadhil Lankarani and was translated by Dr. Ali H. Al-Hakim. It was published by the Islamic Jurisprudence Center of Aima Athar in London and was published in the year 2017. So some information regarding the author. Obviously, Ayatollah Muhammad Jawad Fadhil Lankarani is the son of the late Grand Ayatollah Fadhil Lankarani. May Allah subhanahu elevate and give his soul peace. Ayatollah Lankarani, that is the son, is now the head of a particular institute known as the Institute of A'imma al-Athar. And he has been teaching the advanced levels of fiqh and usul, that is the kharij level of fiqh and usul, that is jurisprudence and the principle of jurisprudence, or what is known as legal theory, for many years in the Islamic seminary or the of Qum. So this is the author of this particular, or the compiler of this particular book. And the translator is Dr. Ahkim, who is currently based in London and has been based in other places, well, especially in Norway. And he has an Iraqi background. So some of the chapters, or rather articles, that are in this particular collection, the first one being the importance of Arba'een, second article, the credibility of the salutation text of Ashura, that is the Ziyara of Ashura, answering some of the doubts and critical points. The third article is the dignity, rationality, and worshipping Allah in Imam Hussein's alayhi salam's martyrdom. The fourth article deals with the system of Arba'een in the struggle and aspiration towards an ideal society. The fifth article deals with preparation for the days of mourning, the anniversary of Imam Hussein's martyrdom. The sixth article, an analysis of Imam Hussein's revolution. And that is the final article. So as you can see, that was the sixth article. This particular collection contains nine different articles. We don't want to go through all of them. So basically, as you can see, it is a collection of articles dealing with different topics that are related to the day of Ashura, are related to Imam Hussein, are related to the day of Arba'een. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of one of these articles from the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners was titled Imam Hussein's Revolution, Rituals and Inspiration. It is a collection of articles by Ayatollah Muhammad Jawad Fadhil Lankarani, the son of the late Ayatollah Al-Uthma Fadhil Lankarani, and it was translated by Dr. Ali Al-Hakim and was published in London. So we would like to read from the second article, titled The Credibility of the Salutation Text of Ashura, answering some of the doubts and critical points. Abstract. This article focuses on aspects of the commemoration of the event of Ashura to provide informative understanding of the Islamic world and endeavors to present explanations backed by Islamic texts, Quranic verses and substantiated narrations. Emphasis is placed on Ziyaratname, the salutation text, and the practice of cursing, presenting opposing views concerning the justification of the permissibility of religiously acceptable cursing. Introduction. Pilgrimage is one of the most effective methods of becoming spiritually, religiously, and emotionally connected with the origin of all realities, that is, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah the Almighty, the High. So, if we visit noble places and blessed shrines of the Prophets alayhi salam and divine guardians, and when in their pure shrines we recite the salutation or the ziyaratname, a salutation text, this is all purely with the intention and for the express purpose of perfecting the levels of our monotheism, i.e. our tawheed, by strengthening our faith, worshipping only Allah the Almighty and trying to achieve nearness to Him. One of the main topics mentioned in these texts is expressing one's servitude as a worshipper of Allah, of God, and refraining from all kinds of polytheism. This teaching or message is the core and soul of all other ziyaratnama salutation texts. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to do the ziyarah and the visitation and to recite the ziyarah of Imam Hussain alayhi salam in Karbala, inshallah, in this year and in every year. By the right of Imam Hussain alayhi salam, inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasir, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
From the heart of beautiful Iran.
Fire clay is basically mud, but a lighter, stickier type of mud with high alumina content. It's actually everywhere around us, but cannot be seen until it is uncovered from the earth. In its raw form, fire clay is found near or between layers of coal in coal mines. People have been extracting it from the ground for millennia to make bricks, ceramicware, tools, homes, and a whole bunch of other things. Its qualities get even better when it's baked and stiffened. This clay has a great number of industrial uses and lasts nearly forever.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week, we're going to venture through the vast world of fire clay and its byproducts. We will take a look at where it comes from and why it is so important to several industries that make our lives hum. We also want to understand just how this item fits into the bigger picture of the national economy. So let's start the show.
Our quest for answers led us to a company that owns and manages at least 5 mines in Fars province. Esteghlal Abadeh company specializes in the extraction of fire clay and the production of clay products. Fire clay is a refractory material that can withstand extremely high temperatures without losing its original properties.
There are other types of refractories that this company also produces in small amounts, such as high alumina and melite ceramics. But its main claim to fame is the production of highly useful fire clay. It might be interesting to know that this company is not just a mine owner. It also has three factories. These factories make products like fire brick, washroom items such as sinks, and industrial ceramics. Its production facilities can make large amounts of ceramic parts that are used in various fields such as blast furnaces for coke, iron, and steel productions. Because fire clay is heat-resistant, this material presents excellent qualities for outdoor flooring purposes. One of the benefits is it doesn't crack or expand when exposed to hot climates. That is why it is widely used across the country, particularly in central and southern regions where temperatures can often exceed 45 degrees Celsius. The quality of fire clay is assessed by its levels of impurities. This company can produce some of the highest-grade fire clays in the West Asian region with around 75% purity. In general, when the material is extracted, it is then transferred to the Research and Development Department where it is tested for quality. One of the competitive advantages of this company over similar firms in this field is the quality of its products that match international standards. This holding company has created dozens of direct job opportunities over the years, and hundreds more people are indirectly hired as well. Out of some 50 fire clay mines nationwide, this mine has been the only producer that extracts its products along the lines of exports. This company has faced many challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Some are related to the fluctuation of domestic raw material prices. As part of its future vision, it has also overhauled production processes to optimize outputs. Besides the mine we just talked about, there is one other major fire clay deposit which is located in Charmahal Bakhtiari province. This mine offers 12 million tons of proven reserves, and it is set to produce some of the best quality refractories in the region. Each year, a combined average of 300,000 tons of fire clay are exported. Iran's tile and ceramic market have become very attractive with rapid socioeconomic development in the West Asian region. Also, there is an increasing need for new housing units in neighboring countries. There are some of the things that are driving Iran's export market in this field. So the country has stepped up its production to gain a larger share of the market. We looked at the latest figures from the Ministry of Industry to gain more insight into the productions in this field. Data showed that in the year 2020, roughly 400 million square meters of tile were produced in Iran. Such productions were estimated to be worth nearly $450 million. These productions were more than local needs, so nearly 160 million square meters of tiles were exported. Industry participants say that this sector is presently operating at only half of its total production capacity, adding that it has high export potential. With this in mind, the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is working with the government to find ways to expand its markets through production. The goal is to increase production levels by 300 million square meters over the next 4 years. Analysts estimate that this will generate an additional $2 billion in foreign revenues if the strategic sector taps into the full capabilities. Fire clay does not only feed the tile productions. It also supplies raw material to manufacturers of sanitary ceramicware such as sinks. Iran currently makes copious amounts of these items. In fact, in the first half of last year alone, over 70,000 tons of sanitary ware were released into the market. Going off on information from the National Customs Administration, these items were mainly exported to neighboring countries. The country's light and heavy construction sector is booming with construction materials in high demands. It is worth noting that domestic raw materials such as fire clay meet 100% of Iran's construction needs. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here are some statistics on the construction materials market. Iran's steel, cement, tile, and ceramic industries produced more than twice the country's internal needs. Last year, exports of these items raked in some $10 billion in foreign revenues. Tile, glass, and ceramic exports compose some $3 billion of total exports. Steel exports accounted for the rest. That's all based on statistics from the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. On another note, the country's mega mining and metal sector, which also supplies the construction sector, has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Industry participants say this was mainly due to the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry, which led to more focus on other sectors. Much of this expansion is in large part made possible by linking research institutions with manufacturers. This step was critical for sharing knowledge in collaborative product development. All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there on the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
The foundation of knowledge-based companies is built on creating income from knowledge rather than natural resources. Firms involved in pharmaceuticals, health biotech, medical equipment, new materials, avionics, telecommunications, information technology, and software are considered to be in the knowledge-based industries. In this program, we are visiting a knowledge-based company that's involved in information technology. Most of the services that governments have to offer to people are in form of simple inquiries. In many of them, people have to make a payment. That includes bills, taxes, and whatnot. This company has managed to facilitate the process and design an online platform named Qabzino. The other group of services do not need payments. Those include checking your social security insurance records or your subsidy records. Such services are offered in another product named Pishkhan 24, which is an online government services counter. The company is also planning to introduce a new product for car-related services to the market in the coming months. This company has managed to expand despite sanctions and other problems. Customer satisfaction has built their trust, and this has been a great incentive for the company to work harder to design new products. They also plan to enter the market and are looking for strategic partners abroad. Their goal is to attract domestic and foreign investment.
There you have it. That covers our program for today. Thanks for joining us and see you next time for more exciting market and industry analysis on Bozor.
Thank you. Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aliyas 60 y 61 de la sura de Anfal del Sagrado Corán, recitadas por el señor Rahnema.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa a'iddu lahum mastata'tum min ومن رباط الخيل ترهبون به عدو الله وعدوكم وآخرين من دونهم لا تعلمونهم الله يعلمهم وما تنفقوا من شيء في سبيل الله يوفى إليكم وأنتم لا تظلمون وإن جنحوا للسلم فاجنح لها وتوكل على الله إنه هو السميع العليم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Busco el refugio de Dios ante los engaños del diablo. En el nombre de Dios, el compasivo, el misericordioso. Preparad contra ellos toda la fuerza, toda la caballería que podáis.